Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Pushkin. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I am joined by singer-songwriter Leve. For those unfamiliar, she's a 24-year-old multi-instrumentalist who first came to prominence at the height of the pandemic for her covers of old jazz standards, which she released via TikTok and Instagram. It's true, her ascent was as improbable as the combination of words I just said. And yet Leve, who was raised between Iceland and Washington, D.C., is an undeniable talent. The rare case of someone going viral for the right reasons. Coming of age in a musical household, the Icelandic Chinese artist grew up on the sounds of Chet Baker, Joe Stafford, and Ella Fitzgerald, all of whom inspired the voice you'll hear throughout this episode as we play a few tracks from her new record entitled Bewitched. It was released this past Friday on September 8th and can now be found wherever you get your music. We sat with Leve ahead of her international tour, where she'll be performing across the U.S. and Europe through the fall and winter. We talked about her incredible arc from making music in her dorm room to performing alongside the Philharmonic orchestras, her Icelandic upbringing, and her ultimate mission to bridge the gap between the past and the present, introducing a new generation to the jazz music of yesteryear. That's all coming up next with our guest, Leve.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Leve, a pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure is all mine. Thank you for having me.
How are you doing in this moment? The record is about to come out. You've had some music videos be released. You're going to go on tour. How are you feeling?
I feel very excited. You know, I'm at the moment right now where there are like a lot of cool things on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the most exciting places to be.
Until they actually happen?
Until they actually happen, yeah. But, you know, sometimes the anticipation is just as fun, if not more fun.
I find that it's usually more fun. I don't know what that says about you and I, but...
I would say that means we're hopeful people.
We're hopeful people.
Hopeful people, yeah.
And does reality disappoint or we just keep rolling with it?
I think we find something new to be hopeful for after, you know, we're doing
passes. This is a good approach.
Yeah.
We're just constantly... I like this reframing. We're just...
Oh, yeah. I'm all about reframing.
Why don't we frame this record and where it sits for you? Because... A year ago, you released your debut album, Everything I Know About Love. And while you were touring the world with that record, you somehow managed to complete another one, seemingly like on the fly, which is now coming out under the title Bewitched. You've called this record the second chapter to my first. I had so many thoughts I needed to get out there and so many songs, too. Where does the beginning of this chapter begin? How would you set the scene for the stories in this album?
Well, I had just finished tour, actually, and it was winter. It was December and January when I wrote all the songs.
That explains it.
Yes. It definitely is a little bit darker tone. I like to say this is the fall, winter to the spring, summer that Everything I Know About Love was. I think in the year and time that I wrote and released Everything I Know About Love, I grew up a lot. I matured a lot, both as a musician and as a young woman. Everything I Know About Love was a lot about growing pains. It was moving away from family for the first time to a new country, dealing with homesickness and not knowing very much about love. It's kind of a play on Everything I Know About Love because the whole album is basically about how I know nothing about love. A very hopeless romantic kind of, you know, falling in love with strangers on the train type of stuff. Whereas I think, you know, in the past 2 years of living here in LA now and touring the world and becoming a musician and growing an audience and becoming 24, I guess, is...
You say that like you're embarrassed.
I'm not embarrassed at all. I just realize now that I say 24 out loud. It's, I guess it's pretty young still. But yeah, I've matured a lot. I think, you know, I'm less confused about a lot of things, confused about new things. And I just had to write about it. And while I have the energy and I want to, as long as I want to write new music and release new music, I'm going to continue doing it. And yeah, so I sat down after tour in December and January. I knew I wanted the album to be called Bewitched.
How did you know that?
I don't know. It just like kind of came to me. I had a concert on Halloween last year in Dublin and I dressed up as a witch and I like tweeted, oh, thank you, Dublin. You bewitched me, but Bewitched with a capital B. And nobody really noticed it until after I announced the Bewitched album and everyone was like, whoa, you knew back then. And yeah, everything I do is very intentional. Like everything has been laid out already for upcoming projects, which I will not speak about, but you can kind of can read into everything.
I didn't even have that on my list of questions, so don't worry. You called this new record a love album, and I thought we'd begin with a song that describes a situation that I think many people have found themselves in. This is like when you're friends with someone, and then suddenly, or sometimes gradually over a period of time, you start having feelings for them.
Right.
I think that's the proper setup for this track.
Yes, I think I know which one you're talking about.
This is called From the Start.
Oh, the burning pain, listening to you harp on about some new soulmate. She's so perfect, blah, blah, blah. Oh, how I wish you'll wake up one day. Run to me, confess your love, at least just let me say that when I talk to you, oh, Cupid.
When you hear that, where does that bring you back to?
I kind of envision, you know, sitting on the sofa with somebody that is like your good friend and you're kind of looking at them and you're like, wait, oh my God, maybe they like me too. And then they start describing this new person that they found that they think is their new soulmate, which I think a lot of people can relate to that kind of sinking feeling you get listening to someone you like talk about someone they like. And I kind of wanted to illustrate that. And because I'm very self-aware and don't take myself too seriously, I wanted the song to have kind of like a little bit of a humorous nature to it.
Is that the blah, blah, blah part?
That's the blah, blah, blah part, yeah. It's the whole song is kind of, you know, painted in sarcastic comments, like the blah, blah, blah. And like one of the verses is, oh, the burning pain. And I kind of just imagine... Nobody really says that. It kind of like, to me, I almost saw like a period drama of like a woman who's like, you know, just needs a beach walk, who needs to go like a mad woman, basically just being like, oh, the burning pain.
The song stands out from the rest of the record. The messy, thorny feelings of unrequited love. You couch that in a very breezy bossa nova track. How did you feel making it?
It was all a very easy process. Like that song, I think out of all the songs on the album, came like the easiest to me. I wrote it very quickly in like 20 or 30 minutes. And I knew exactly what I wanted the production to be like. I wanted it to closely resemble the bossa nova recordings of like the 60s and like my favorite bossa nova recordings, like the Jobim and Astrud Gilberto recordings. So everything was recorded live, all live instruments. And I had a very, very clear vision for it. And I think I brought it to my producer, Spencer, and we worked it out so quickly. I knew he would nail exactly what I wanted. And yeah, it was all just a very easy process. It almost seemed too easy.
Is that typical for you, that it comes that quickly?
Yeah, honestly, the songs that I love the most and feel very deeply about are the ones that, you know, I'm just speaking such truth and they come out so easily that it just...
You're not laboring over it.
There are definitely songs where I like revisit after a week maybe and change one lyric, but not really. The songs are pretty much the same from when they're written to final recording.
you're kind of describing someone that's not precious about it, and yet you're very intentional about it.
Yeah, well, you know, halfway through the song, if I don't think it's going to be a recording, and if I'm not passionate about it, I kind of just shelf it. And I think I understand my process very well. And the songs that, you know, run out like butter, the ones that I finish very quickly and have a very clear vision for from first verse, those are truly my most popular songs.
And thinking about that bossa nova track, you said of Bewitched that you wanted to lean into your roots more than you did on your first album.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by that?
My kind of guiding light as a musician is to keep jazz and classical traditions alive and bring them to a new audience. It's just always been the kind of music I loved, and I had so much access to it growing up, and not that many people have that much access to it. So I kind of wanted to bridge that gap between, you know, my generation and this older music. But I didn't know completely how to do it. And in my first album, it was, although very, you know, jazzy still, I played more with like modern production elements. You know, there's some drum machine in there and like some lo-fi kind of, you know, sounds. And I wanted to see how far I could poke into jazz without repelling, you know, Gen Z. But what I found after the first album was that the songs that my fans seemed to like the most were the songs that most closely resembled jazz standards,
mm-hmm.
or the songs that were literally recorded with a symphony orchestra, much to my pleasure, because that's my favorite kind of music and that's what I feel like I'm here to do. So for this album, after like gaining a bit more confidence and having that information, I just decided to lean fully into that. So all of the instruments are recorded live. Like, I was very strict about that. I didn't want any, you know, MIDI or synth or any like computer, really. It's all like live instruments playing.
The childhood you kind of alluded to is one where you split time between Iceland and Washington, D.C. Your mother worked as a classical violinist.
Mm-hmm.
Inside that musical household, when we're thinking about like those roots, who were those early influences that you pulled from for this new record?
You know, a lot of classical composers. I have my first composition on Bewitched, which is, it's called Nocturne, which is kind of like, it means night poem, which I thought was just very fitting for the piece, very fitting for the album, but also is
the fall
kind
winter
of like
album.
The fall winter album, exactly. And also, I thought, you know, of course, the Chopin nocturnes are very, very well known and inspired me a lot. There's a lot of touches of like French impressionism, like Ravel and Debussy. Then there's more obviously, there's Chet Baker, Nat King Cole, Ella Fitzgerald, the kind of jazz greats that I really drew inspiration from. Gershwin is one of my favorite composers. Kind of like one of the first people to bridge the gap between classical and jazz music. Those were kind of like my early inspirations that stay my inspirations.
Tell me if I get this wrong, but isn't one of your earliest musical memories that of you and your twin sister in the backseat of a car as your mother's driving, listening to some of that classical music you talked about?
Sitting in the back of the family car after school beside my sister, and it's like lightly raining and on my way to a piano lesson, and hearing like whatever I was practicing in that moment, playing in the car, or it's some Mozart or Bach or something. That is my childhood in a nutshell. Like, those are the sounds of my childhood. And to this day, when I'm driving, like, I always prefer classical music over anything else.
Why is that?
I think it's very calming, and it's very, and now for me, it just, you know, I live so far away from home now. My family lives in Iceland and I'm all the way out in LA. And one way to kind of feel at home, especially in the afternoon when everyone I love is asleep, it kind of is a way of bringing myself home.
It brings you back there.
Yeah.
You're given the violin at the age of 2, piano lessons starting at 4, cello at 8. As a kid, going to and from those lessons, hours and hours of practicing, did music feel like a calling, or did it feel more like classwork?
I think the first few years of it, you know, you don't question it. You get put in piano lessons at 4. It's kind of, I was always a very goody two-shoes, if you will. Like, I followed the rules and I did what my parents told me. But I don't know. It felt somewhere between class and calling. Like, I knew there was something there and I enjoyed it enough. Like, my parents would have never push me that hard if I didn't enjoy it. I think my mother really saw that and made sure that I continued practicing. And when I turned, 14 or 15, my mom said, I've done my job. You can quit if you want. Do whatever you want.
She said that?
I pushed you now. Yeah. She's a violin teacher as well. She knows how kids operate. And I agree, if a parent sees a natural kind of taking to it and a certain amount of talent, I think I'm so thankful for my mother to have made sure that I kept practicing, because I'm still running on that stamina and technique every single day. This all sounds really serious, but the amount of discipline and focus and appreciation for the art form that it taught me, I'm so thankful for. And yeah, when I became a teenager, she was like, you do whatever you want. And at that point, I was like, I don't want to quit. I love this. And that's when I started singing, and I loved singing so much, and it became my thing.
As you were getting better and better at all these instruments, you've talked a lot about how you grew up in a household where you would always hear someone practicing, whether that was your sister or your mother. Do you ever remember a moment where you thought to yourself, oh my God, my mom is so good at this?
Yes, I do remember. Because, you don't think too much like that about your parents until you've reached a certain age.
Yeah.
You kind of take it for granted. You're just like, oh yeah, this is my mother. And when I turned into a teenager and I was starting to go to music school, not only for lessons, but I was in orchestra, in music theory, getting to know the other kids. And everyone was saying, you're so lucky you have a musician mother. Your mother's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
You're so lucky that she understands music and she can give you practicing tips and understand what you love. And I just realized, wow, I'm so lucky. There are kids that have to fight their parents to be able to pursue music.
Right.
My parents were pushing me to do music. So yeah, my mom is the coolest. I think every week growing up, I'd watch her play at the symphony and I didn't think much of it. And then when I became older and my brain started to develop more, now I see my mother on stage and I'm like, wow, she is so cool.
I like what you said there. That's for a lot of people that were creative teenagers, oftentimes their creativity is formed by resistance.
Mm-hmm.
It's formed by a tension, a push and pull between what they really want to do and what their parents are telling them to do. And yet yours seem to be fortified by your parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember I was really scared of going to pursue music, extremely scared. I always valued safety as a teenager. And
what do you mean by that?
I was very careful, I was scared that I wouldn't be able to become a musician and that I wouldn't have a job and that I wasn't good enough or beautiful enough to do it. Those were all factors in it. And so I kind of thought to myself, well, I'm just going to go to regular university. So I applied to universities in the UK, and the only music school I applied to was Berklee, where I ended up going.
Mm.
And I got into these universities in the UK and these kind of dream fairy tale universities, and was going to go to one called St. Andrews with my twin sister. It's a university in Scotland. And then last minute, Berklee called me and offered me the scholarship that would basically cover everything, their presidential scholarship. And nobody says no to that. They called me and they're like, welcome to Berklee. And I remember feeling like my entire choice had been taken away, the universe had decided for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember feeling such a loss of control and being really scared, because I was like, why are they giving me this scholarship? I was like, even if I don't have to pay for school, that doesn't guarantee that I'll become a musician. And I was that scared of becoming a musician. I had this institution literally telling me, we believe in you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still I don't know. And my mother sat me down and she was like, you're going to Berklee. She was like, you're going to music school because this is your passion and this is your calling. And she was like, I will go with you. She flew with me to Boston and stayed with me for a week and made sure I acclimated before she left. And she was like, if you don't like it, we'll go somewhere else. But you owe this to yourself. You're meant to do this. And of course I wanted to. I just didn't believe that it would happen.
Well, let me ask you, why do you think after receiving a letter and a call that says, we've chosen you, we're giving you the presidential scholarship, is that what it was?
Yeah.
Most people would maybe get that and go, all right, I feel emboldened by it, or this is validating. And yet you felt still unclear.
I didn't believe in myself enough. I knew that music came naturally to me, almost so naturally that it didn't feel realistic that I could turn it into something tangible. I wanted to become a singer the most, but I hadn't figured out how to mix together. I was like, I'm a classical cellist and a jazz singer, and I love Taylor Swift. I was like, how do I mix these things together? It makes no sense. I had no example for someone who had done it before. And quite frankly, I became the example that I needed.
Well, you're kind of wondering aloud, how the hell do you combine all these forces? And I thought maybe we would play a new song from your new record, which is written as a letter to your 13-year-old self. Since we're talking about you as a teenager, maybe we should listen to it.
This is a perfect, perfect choice for this conversation.
Okay, I'm 2 for 2. Good.
One day you'll be up on stage. Little girls will scream your name. The days of tears and failure, fears and no one cares will all make sense. 'Cause you'll grow up and grow so confident and write your story, fall in love a little too, the things you thought you squeeze myself at 13 and just let her know that she's beautiful.
I was watching you really like look deeply off into the distance down over there.
Oh, that's me. Yeah, you know, I haven't listened to that in a while. It always really touches me. When I wrote that song, I started crying, which has never happened before. I have a pretty hard shell when it comes to stuff like that, but that one really broke me down.
Which part of it?
Every part of it. I don't think I've written a song where every line feels so extremely honest and true and just exactly what I needed to say and exactly what my 13-year-old self needed to hear. I was almost surprised at myself that it rhymed because it was just exactly what I would have said anyways. The last verse, one day you'll be up on stage and little girls will scream your name. That one really got me because I just had this vision of girls that maybe feel like that. And I also say in one of the verses, like, try to say my foreign name and laugh. And the fact that that very name is being screamed up on stage by little girls like years later, it just really got me. And I was just so thankful for everything that I have. And I just started crying.
I think that's a normal response to that song.
Also, the way that I, you know, arranged it and produced it was, you know, I played piano, cello and guitar on it. And I wanted it to almost sound like a little girl practicing, like a little version of me. So you hear like these very arpeggiated piano parts and simple cello parts, and I just wanted it to kind of capture that innocence of a 13-year-old.
It's fascinating because as you're describing that 13, 14-year-old, it's hard to imagine that she would then make that move to America that you mentioned, where you leave Iceland for Boston, and it's there in Boston that you attended the Berklee School of Music. But it's funny because within your first year there, you turn 20 years old. Of that day, you said, I went from being a child to an adult in a second.
Wow, you really dug deep. Wow, that was somewhere really, really deep in the back of my brain. Yeah, I did a lot of growing up in that year, like a lot and a lot of growing up. That was my first year away from home, my first time drinking, my first time going to parties, my first time dating.
You were drinking at 20? Uh-oh.
Not very much, but still, I, you know, that was my first year being away from my twin sister. That was my year of becoming an individual. And I started thinking about more about how I looked and dressed, and I started wearing makeup, and boys started to give me any kind of attention. It was a lot of change in a really small window of time.
That sounds like a lot.
It was a lot, yeah.
How did you handle all of that?
I had a bit of a rough patch there that first year, and at the end of it, I had my first, I don't talk about this a lot, but I really had my first kind of experience with depression and anxiety. I think I grew up almost skimming past mental health a bit. I was just so focused and such a good kid that it just almost passed me by. And then all of a sudden, I was faced with all these new obstacles and all these new feelings and you know, getting rejected for the first time. And it was just, and being away from my family, who I am so close to, I remember I would just like walk around, and every single day it felt like I couldn't get this like gray cloud away from me. But I remember thinking like, I'm so unhappy, like I don't know how to get out of it. And it was writing that really got me out of it. I wrote Street by Street, my first song, you know, at the tail end of that, and it truly got me out of it. And that was like the first song I'd really written. And it was ended up being the first song I put out and did kind of, you know, kickstart my career. It's wild, but you really do have those movie moments, and that was one of them. That was a lot, but
no, it was not. It was totally fun.
I've never talked about that actually, but I think I tend to downplay things to, actually, I don't. I lay everything out in my songs, so it's all out there.
Well, then I guess we have to play a little bit of Street by Street.
Street by Street, my first baby.
Step by step, brick by brick, I'm reclaiming what's mine. This city is way too small to give away to just one guy. Street by street,
I have a question. When my theory of the song, here's my theory.
Uh-huh.
As I was listening to that right now.
Yes.
I was brought back to my first year in college. I was in San Francisco. And after the first semester, I broke up with the first woman I ever dated.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember walking to campus and going to classes and thinking, shit, I can't take the same routes that I took with her. And so I started inventing new routes, except I took these circuitous paths that took me way out of the way, and I was late to class, and I was like, you know what? I'm walking the same way.
Yeah.
This time alone.
You reclaimed your city is what you did. You street by streeted that.
I street by streeted it.
Yeah.
I think this was like 10 years before the song existed.
Well, I think one of the beauties of writing about love so soon after you experience anything like that for the first time is that you see it in such a simple way. When you've had certain things repeated again and again, you start to take them just, they're just, it is what it is. You don't think about it. But I remember like this was the first time somebody had kind of ghosted me, if you will.
So this was someone you were seeing.
This is someone I went on a couple of dates with in Boston, like the first guy I went on like repeated dates with. It didn't work out. Anyways, he was like, this isn't going to work out. And I remember being so shattered and looking back, like, yes, I may have been a little bit dramatic, but when it's the first time that happens, it's very dramatic. And I remember walking down the street in Boston and just like, I'd look up at a building and I'd just be like, that's where he goes. And you know, it's like everything was kind of ruined for me, and I just kept on thinking like, whoa, does everybody go through this where it's just like you can't walk around the city because it reminds you of this neighborhood? It was tainted. And I would escape to New York every weekend because I just didn't want to be in Boston. And I wrote actually the lyrics to the chorus of Street by Street in the Megabus from Boston to New York, because I was leaving Boston and I saw the skyline kind of fade away and I was like, oh, well, this is kind of stupid, isn't it? I'm not going to let a boy take an entire city away from me. So Street by Street was born.
After the break, more from our guest, Levy.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at tmobile.com/now.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
You know, the other part of that song, of hearing that song, are you brought back to the actual conditions of making it? Because my understanding is, you finished the track or laid down the initial take of it on the last day.
Mm-hmm. We recorded the entire song in 5 hours, I think, the day that we left or thrown off of campus.
Because of the pandemic.
And I knew, I was like, you know, if we don't come back, like, I'm never going to record this song because I'd never recorded a song before. So I was like, this is my chance to do it. I'm not going to be doing it at home in this 2-week vacation that I thought COVID would be. Yeah, it really brings me back. The song brings me back to Boston. It brings me back to that time.
You finish that song. You pack up your stuff with your parents.
I believe my sister and my mother basically packed up my entire dorm while I was recording the song. My sister will tell you about it. If you ever have the chance of meeting her, but she is still to this day, she's like, you owe me.
I feel like they both deserve a producer credit on the song.
Yeah, sure.
No, you don't think so? Oh, I feel like you got to give them some residuals. They packed up your stuff.
They did. And it was a crucial step.
Am I guilting you enough?
That's okay. My twin sister guilts me a lot, so I'm quite used to it.
I'm working on her behalf right now.
You really sound like you are. Yeah, I'll give him producer credit in my heart.
So you're playing the song that we just heard, like again and again and again,
mm-hmm.
back at home.
Yes.
Where you were living with your mom, your sister, your family mm-hmm. during the pandemic.
Yes.
Walk me through your time in that period, because the pandemic, once it began in like March of 2020, when I think back on that time, I do kind of associate your music with it, because that's when a lot of people began to discover like you and your work.
Yeah.
So tell me how that felt and what that was like in those early months of the pandemic.
Well, I got back home from Berkeley and just saw this vacuum of time in front of me. And I thought, this is a really great time for me to hone in my artistry, practice as much songwriting as possible, write as much as possible, and just post little videos of myself singing online. And quite literally, like the first video I posted, I was playing cello and singing It Could Happen to You, a jazz standard. It like went viral, I think, genuinely like a week or two into the pandemic. And I think I gained like 10,000 followers overnight or something. It was wild. And I remember being like, oh my God, all these people are watching and I may as well continue. And so I just kept on doing it every mm-hmm. day, every other day. I was on a really strict schedule with myself. I just posted a video of an original song or a jazz standard.
How would you pick the songs?
Just whatever I was feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And then whatever I had written that day. It was like a school of songwriting and jazz standarding that I like entered into. And I thought, this is my opportunity to maybe introduce some of these songs. Like, to them, they're new. And of course, there were people who recognized the songs from movies or from their parents playing them or stuff. And so I just kept on going. And then, you know, I'd written a lot more songs and I recorded one more with the same producer as I produced Street by Street with, just over the internet. And that came out. And then I kind of learned the ropes of social media. I think I liken this time as like the part in the movie where the company is being made and numbers are flying everywhere and everyone's over-caffeinated. That is exactly what that time felt like. I feel like I was over-caffeinated that entire time. And I had this like blind drive for it because there was nothing to lose. You were in this like weird safety net of the pandemic. I was just at home and I was doing online school. And I remember sitting with in front of Zoom and my guitar on the side, just waiting for the class to finish so I could like, you know, write more or record another video. It was crazy.
That's usually the best time in the movie.
Oh, best time in the movie. And that felt exactly like that. Like, I kid you not. Like, if I look back at that time, it's like, all I see is like numbers and like thinking and like just like blur.
I want to play one of the standards that you covered.
Okay.
That was early on in this process.
Yeah, this could be any standard, really.
I don't think you could guess what I'm going to play.
I probably couldn't. Can you give me...
A time frame?
Not a time frame, but a word.
It's a collaborative one.
Okay, is it Ella and Louis?
It's one with you and your friend.
Oh, I see. It's me.
These Foolish Things.
That is an early one with Claudia.
You don't like that?
I love it.
This is like maybe my favorite.
Maybe one of my favorite.
Okay,
videos I've ever done.
We're gonna play it. So,
okay,
this is you and your friend Claudia mm-hmm. singing These Foolish Things.
A tinkling piano in the next apartment. Those stumbling words that told you. What my heart meant, a fairground's painted sweet. These foolish things remind me of you. You came telephone that rings, but who's to answer? Oh, how the ghost of you clings. These foolish things remind me of you.
Oh, that's so cute. I love that so much. Claudia's so talented.
What were you thinking about watching that?
I was just brought back.
Yeah.
I was, you know, we were singing just to sing. I didn't have an audience or anything. I just thought Claudia was so amazing and I wanted to sing with her. And we both knew this standard and we were in a practice room and we just did it like in one take and it was just fun. Like, I remember it wasn't for any type of gain other than just singing. I haven't thought about that in a while. I think there's kind of like a misconception that you have to turn every kind of art into capitalize on some sort of way. And in that moment, I just wanted to sing with my friend. And it was really special.
Something that's fascinating that I wanted to just kind of like throw out there was in that period from April 2020 to the end of 2021, you do more and more jazz standards and cover those tracks. I was thinking about that first hesitation you had at the beginning of this interview where you were like, oh, I wasn't sure how jazzy I could get with Gen Z. And yet most people discovered you through these songs that were born 100 years ago. Sung by some of our probably favorite musicians. And I wondered if you think people especially liked it in that moment because all we had was the past. The future was a little hard to imagine in the middle of the pandemic. And you seem to be offering like a window back into what used to be and what could be on the other side of this.
Yeah, I think that definitely played into it. It was a time where you didn't want to be reminded of the current times. Like, politics were weird. There was a pandemic going on. Nobody was in school. Nobody was dating. And to be like a teenager or a young 20-something was really odd. It kind of felt like you were missing out on what everyone told you were going to be the best years of your life. So I think what happened is that people were going back to things that didn't feel like it had a timestamp on it. And I think me singing these jazz songs kind of didn't seem like it had a timestamp on it. It seemed timeless, kind of.
What did your mother make of these videos as they start to go like viral online?
She loved it. She's always been my biggest supporter. Her belief around this is like, I knew it would happen. She's like, of course. She was like, now everyone's catching up. And I'm like, Mama, no, I've worked for this. And she's like, it was meant to happen. I was like, great. So all this practicing I've done means nothing. No, I'm kidding.
You know, now that we're in this period where you can go out and perform and, and you're performing for fans for the first time, I was thinking, you said that last song we played was made in one take, just the two of you, with no expectation of audience or hundreds of thousands or millions of people listening. Has having that audience changed how you approach these songs?
Not at all.
You don't think about it at all?
I don't think about it at all. No. In fact, I just posted a video on TikTok this morning just singing Dream a Little Dream of Me. I hadn't done it in a second, so I just thought it'd be fun. Now I'm getting to the place where people don't know me for that. And to get to sing those songs and kind of, I mean, my music, you know, resembles jazz standards, but they aren't them. So now when I get to sing them, it's like a special treat and really introducing something new to a new audience, which is, you know, the goal of this whole thing. So no, I don't think I do anything differently.
And performing in front of fans, has there been a moment where you thought, oh my God?
I mean, every time there are fans singing my lyrics back to me, whether it be a 200-person room or a 2,000-person room, it's so beyond me. I recently did my first round of shows in Asia and Australia, and That was a pretty like pinch me moment. I had a show in Jakarta where it was like around 5,000 people and they were all screaming the lyrics along. And they were solo shows, so it was really shocking to me. And Singapore and Manila as well, they were really the biggest shows I'd ever played. They were like four times the size of the biggest show that I played in my last US tour. So I was like so surprised that I'd traveled all this way and I was in front of a similar group of kids that obviously were like-minded and connecting to the music and this music that's considered old-fashioned to
many. Right.
It felt really special. I kind of can't believe it's happening.
One of the reasons I wanted to like sit with you and maybe introduce you to our audience, which skews a little older.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, of course, probably know you already, but just for those who don't, there's this long-standing complaint that we hear. I'm 28, you're 24. So you're the generation before me. But even with my generation, they go, they don't care about the past. They don't know anything about older music. They're disassociated from like all the good stuff that has made this new stuff possible. And yet, like sitting before me is a 24-year-old whose newest record is inspired by Chet Baker, Joe Stafford, and a whole lot of people that have been gone for a very, very long time. So when you hear older folks, usually in the boomer generation, go, yeah, you don't know anything about old music.
Uh-huh.
What do you say to that?
I don't think anyone's ever said that to me, so I haven't been in that situation.
Maybe no one said it to you, but you've heard stuff like that before.
About, you know, of course I've heard, you know, older generations complain about younger generations and them not having an appreciation for quote-unquote real art.
Exactly.
I haven't had that experience. Like, my experience with current listenership is that they're kind of down to listen to anything. If anything, they romanticize the old. And that's not only like the old, like I'm trying to, you know, bring back. It's like, you know, you hear all these 90s songs, like have breathing new life, like songs from the 80s, songs from the 70s, Fleetwood Mac having big moments, uh-huh, on TikTok. And then you have like the Mazzy Stars who are like huge now. And so I think what Gen Z cares about is relatability. And they want the music to be fed to them through mediums that feel relatable to them. Historically, young people don't want to listen to what old people say. Young people want to listen to what other young people say. So I think that's the reason that I kind of realize I am young, so I can do this. But that hasn't been my experience at all. But, you know, if they say anything, I'm like, I am not trying to recreate old music. I'm not trying to recreate Chet Baker Sings. And frankly, when people ask me, like, why haven't you done a standards album yet? I'm like, I will eventually. And I'm so excited for that day. But go listen to Chet Baker. Go listen to Louis Armstrong, Coltrane. Go listen to these incredible recordings that sound old because they are old. And they really do hark back to a different time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking inspiration from that and creating something new with my new stories.
I love what you said about the younger generation and romanticizes the past in some
Definitely.
Ways.
Definitely. Yeah.
That seems to like feed into this other big narrative around this romanticizing your life thing. I don't know, trend, I guess it's called.
Yeah,
I feel like
it's huge.
I feel like anytime I talk about it, I sound so old.
No, not at all. And it's you know, it's woven into, it's been this trend. It is a trend.
Can
really,
you explain it to people that maybe are not that familiar?
I'm not sure exactly where it was born out of. I believe it was like TikTok or Instagram.
Yes.
But basically, I personally think the reason that the romanticize your life movement was born was because of the bleak reality of COVID. So romanticize your daily neighborhood walk. It becomes a romanticized walk. Enjoy your homemade cup of coffee. Romanticize the process of making it. These simple things. It's been huge with people who don't live in New York City or Paris. People who live in the middle of America and they can make beauty out of something very simple. And I completely subscribe to this practice. I think it's a beautiful thing. I definitely had to romanticize a lot of things growing up in Iceland. It's cold 10 months out of the year and dark half of the year, all day, all night. So yeah, I think romanticizing your life is just a form of optimism.
Well, a whole lot of people have been romanticizing their lives to a soundtrack you have provided. And so as we leave, I want to play a song from this new record. Now, I've chosen every song to this point. I'm going to now give the floor over to you, and I'll let you choose whatever song you think people ought to hear or should hear at the end of this hour together.
I think let's throw Promise in there.
Okay.
Yeah, Promise.
This is Promise by Leve off her new record, Bewitched.
So I broke my promise. I called you last night. I shouldn't have. I wouldn't have if it weren't for the sight of a boy who to be nothing with you. It hurts to be something, it's worse to be nothing with you.
To hear that song after the jazz cover you did, Street by Street, it's kind of a remarkable evolution in these last 3 or 4 years. It's happened so quickly.
I know, it's crazy.
How do you feel listening to that?
I feel very proud. I think I've grown. I'm very happy that I can have an album with songs that are jazz standards and songs that are more like this, and it feel cohesive. It's all my words, my thoughts, and my playing and my voice that kind of, you know, are the common denominator. This one I'm very proud of. I love the very classical kind of undertones of it. You know, there's an interlude in the middle that I'm kind of quoting classical arpeggiated sounds. I played piano and cello on that. And yeah, it's another one of those songs where I said exactly what I felt and what I needed to say.
Do you think, as we've charted the trajectory, which has been pretty short, but still 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, I released my first song 3 years ago now.
Yeah. It's been like 3 years.
Yeah. But it's been, you know, 20 years of practice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you think in the work you're getting closer and closer to capturing the experiences that you're writing about? Like, do you think the more you do this, the closer to the bone it gets?
Not necessarily. I think, you know, with every song I write, with every year that I go through, whatever I'm writing always feels what's most honest to me now in the moment, right? So when I look back at, you know, the first songs I released, I don't directly relate to them anymore, but that's how I felt honestly in that moment. Same with the songs I wrote a year ago. I may not feel like that anymore, but that was my experience then. So I've always stayed quite true to myself. I think I keep changing, so my songs keep changing,
right,
but they're always very honest, which is really fun because, you know, like I mentioned in the letter to my 13-year-old self, one of the lyrics is, you'll write your story, and this is me writing my story.
Well, we have been, I think, trying to tell some of that story together on this podcast. I'm thinking about the 11-year-old you, who's like insisting to her mother, I'm going to bring jazz into the 21st century.
Yeah.
Which is maybe the weirdest thing an 11-year-old has ever desired.
I was a weird kid.
That's very clear. And we thank you for your weirdness.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly do.
It's given me a career.
Damn right it has. I'm just thinking back. You had this plan even then at 11. And so if we were to do this again and 5 years, You're 29. Maybe for you, for us, for young people listening, you wrote this song that you wanted your 13-year-old self to hear, that she could not. If you were to write a song that your 24-year-old self could hear, what would be some of those lines, those lyrics for you in this moment?
That's a great question. It's very difficult because I'm not 29. I mean, I would probably tell myself to similar things, but a little bit grown up, but not to worry too much.
Do you worry less now than you did then?
No. But I'm more optimistic in my hopes and dreams.
Mm.
I'm at the point in my life right now where I don't see many walls, many limits. If you would have told me 3 years ago that I'd have a song charting on global charts that had scatting in it and selling out the concerts that I am today, I would have never believed you. So I've definitely expanded my dreams a little bit, and I think you kind of carve your own path. I didn't have the example for it. That's why. I hadn't seen anyone do with the kind of music I make do what I have done. I didn't have an example. I didn't know who to follow. And now that I've done what I've done, I know that I don't need someone to follow. I can just trudge ahead.
Well, as you trudge ahead, whatever's to come in the next 5 years, whatever music you make, whatever you put out into the world, I am so looking forward to hearing it.
Me too. Me too.
Leve, a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to leave us 5 stars on Spotify, Apple, wherever you do your listening. I also want to give a special thanks this week to Cammy and Bianca at AWOL, and of course, our guest, Leve. To hear her new album, Bewitched, and to learn more about her work, visit our show notes at talkeasypod.com. For more conversations like this one, I'd recommend our talks with Lord, Blood Orange, Vince Staples, Esty and Alana Haim, Arlo Parks, and David Byrne. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at TalkEasyPod. If you want to purchase one of our mugs, they come in cream or navy, or our vinyl record with the inimitable cantankerous writer Fran Lebowitz, you can do so at TalkEasyPod.com/shop. I also want to give a special thanks to our incredible team. Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janix Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Our research and production assistant is Paulina Suarez. Today's episode was edited by Clarice Guevara and mixed by Andrew Vastola. Our assistant editors are CJ Mitchell and Lindsay Ellis. Our music is by Dylan Peck. Our illustrations are by Krisha Shenoy. Our photographs are by Julius Chu. Video and graphics by Ian Chang, Derek Gabrizak, Ian Jones, and Ethan Seneca. I also want to thank our team at Pushkin Industries. Justin Richmond, Julia Barton, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, David Glover, Heather Fain, Eric Sandler, Jordan McMillan, Isabella Narvaez, Kira Posey, Tara Machado, Maya Koenig, Jason Gambrell, Justine Lang, Lital Malad, Malcolm Gladwell, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next week with a new episode. Until then, stay safe and so on.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey, everyone. This is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets in the car, while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.